Hello and welcome to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz. Good to be here, Jake. There's another inside joke for that just... Only the two of us get.
I forgot to mention I'm from Guelph Politico.
Jake Nicholson. And I'm just from here.
There you go.
I'm from the control booth.
You're from the control booth.
Live from the control booth now.
Right across the hall.
Yes.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we'll bring the mail because Canada Post won't be tomorrow. No, seriously. They extended the deadline for the lockout till Monday, so there will be mail tomorrow. But the Postal Workers Union has refused arbitration now, so it seems that after the weekend, there won't be any mail for a while. But the question is, will the general public notice, and what effect might this have on small businesses that depend on Canada Post for its freight? And also, what is the status of the future of the post office going to look like after this? And we will try and dig into that. And then after the break, we will have James Gordon in studio for the fourth in our 12-part series of interviews with city councilors of the city of Guelph. James Gordon, of course, is no stranger to CFRU. He is a renowned singer-songwriter, presently promoting his 14th solo album, Sunny Jim. But we're going to be more interested in his other part-time job at City Hall, and we'll be talking about his work on social justice, transit issues, getting recognition for our local First Nations at council meetings, and all that good stuff. But first, speaking of social justice, it was an otherwise pleasant Sunday afternoon when Black Lives Matter, those ruinous ruiners, decided to hijack the Pride Parade for their own selfish ideals. At least that seemed to be the reaction, although I think some people have kind of chilled out since Sunday. There was definitely a large visceral reaction to what happened with Black Lives Matter Toronto, who were the honored group leading the parade. And then the parade was about to kick off, and they had a spontaneously planned sit-in, or a planned spontaneous sit-in, to talk about their issues. They had a list of demands, would not let the parade get going until the demands were met. And the co-chair of Toronto Pride, Mathieu Chantalois, did sign them. The demands, the most controversial of which was to no longer have the police welcomed in a float, in the form of a float or any other sort of official presence at future Pride events. I'm not sure how you're going to have an event that attracts over a million people without police involvement somehow, but it was interesting sort of watching this go down, Scotty, because I don't know about you, but I'm sort of like half and half. Like, yeah, they were raising some legitimate points, but, you know, when they were the honored guest, it's like, you know, it's like I invite
like
you
the
over.
Guest had too much to
I
drink
invite you over to my house, yeah. And you protest the idea of me holding a dinner party and, you know, sit in front of the stove so we can't get the roast out of the oven and everyone's hungry and nobody can eat.
Yes. from what you were saying about it, I'm fairly sure the protest wasn't spontaneous. I think it was actually planned and well-crafted, because you don't show up with the list of demands and that beautiful quill pen. Quill pen, the ostrich feather, whatever it was.
Yeah.
It's like, if you want something signed at Pride, that's the pen you use. Like, somebody said, anybody got a pen? That is the pen.
Yeah.
But I think, well, and you were saying about the backlash. It sounds like a lot of the backlash was this like deep-seated racism coming at Black Lives Matter.
Oh, some of it was.
But what did they actually do? And from my perspective, somebody who's been in a lot of parades and marches, I've actually never been to Pride. I will go one of these years. They, within an instant, repoliticized the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because what happened? What was top of the news? I mean, Pride has gone to the point now, you know, a million people are there in various capacities, either on-duty police or off-duty police, the people in the parade and whatnot. But within an instant there, they turned the tables. Mm-hmm. So in terms of getting a political message across, they did it. They did it. Because thinking back, or looking back in time, how did Pride start? Pride started...
Bathhouse raids.
Bathhouse raids. Why? Because the police were after this community.
Yeah.
So At this point, if you look at the Pride Parade, you'd say, okay, just in looking out on the surface, you say the police are no longer the enemy. They're in the parade. There would be a lot of police on duty as well, too, considering how many people are there. But Black Lives Matter and their community are saying, look, wait a second. Think back to April when Black Lives Matter were out front of the police headquarters there. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like they objected to them having a fire, an open fire, and sleeping there. But if you can look up that video, you'll see the police coming out and going at them. And people were, you know, manhandled, let's say. I don't know if that's even appropriate language anymore. and still no answer as to who shot Andrew Locu, who was not in the, and to tell you the truth, I don't know if I missed something, and maybe it's, you know, I didn't realize that there was that deep a kernel of LGBTQT in Black Lives Matter until this weekend. And I don't know if that's just that I'm oblivious to it, or I didn't see it, or just assumed that was there. But I honestly never saw it as connected to the movement. I do now. So,
well, yeah.
And that was very clear. But we think back to the days beyond 1981 where Pride was sort of becoming official, and people like Jack Layton on council were advocating for it in the mid-80s, where there was a bit of an awakening going on. Art Angleton still wouldn't officially sanction the march.
Right.
So it's not that long ago. It's within a range of less than 30 years ago where this was still a bit, you know, on the fringe.
Mm-hmm.
And there still is a group's on it within the fringe. What do they call it? The night march that they had the week before.
Right.
Because I guess during Pride Month now, it went from a day to a week to a month. There are groups that, you know, have several objections to Pride, not only, I guess, a group like Black Lives Matter who were objecting to the inclusivity of the thing, but also the corporate nature of it. Because, I mean, when you're being sponsored by banks and, you know, you name it, Trojan condoms, whoever the sponsors are, there's a certain expectation there. And also, in my view, if the police are in the parade, mm-hmm. whether they're LGBTQT or whatever, there is also a certain expectation there, right? That you're sort of, you become mainstream, right?
Right.
So I think it's in terms of what they're asking for. I don't know if they'll get what they're asking for next year. But in terms of making a political statement, mission accomplished.
Their demands were not terribly unreasonable. Like stuff like more funding and support for Black queer youth. You know, funding more community stages. The South Asian stage was canceled because of lack of interest or something, but they want to bring that back. More Black interpreters, I think, was also another demand. The big one, though, was definitely the police one. And I think the politics, you're right about them bringing the politics back to the parade, and perhaps there is a legitimate argument to be made about how maybe it's become too corporate. But it's the police thing that is interesting, because putting aside the tumultuous relationship between people of color and the Toronto police, presently there has actually been tremendous strides on the part of Toronto police to recognize that past, that bathhouse raid past, and trying to address it. And, you know, being in Pride and having their float there, I think, and there, of course, there was the letter by the police officer who identifies as LGBT, the open letter he wrote as well. Like, I'm not part of the Great Blue Machine. I'm also not part of the Great Rainbow Machine. I'm just a cop who happens to be gay, or I'm a gay person who happens to be cop. So, I mean, there's kind of a... It seems like Black Lives Matter is angry that the LGBT community seems to be having this good relationship with the police. Perhaps I'm reading too much into the intentions there. But they also... There was the formal apology a couple of weeks ago that BLM disrupted as well. And so between that and this, it seems like... You guys are kind of stealing our press, and you're having your issues addressed, and we're not having our issues addressed. And I think perhaps that is the root of some of the discomfort. I mean, the racism stuff, like them getting hate mail and threats and stuff, that is unacceptable no matter what the circumstances. I mean, they could be protesting, you know, using the color pink in Pride and or something like that, and people would turn it into a race thing. I mean, that stuff is inexcusable. But I think for a lot of people, you know, you can't just... the thing that seems to be, like, even though it started as a political event, it has become very apolitical. And the reason you know that is because, and this comes back to the police issue, the police have to be there. Why? Because the prime minister was there, the premier was there, the mayor of the city was there, the official opposition leader of both the province and the feds was there. Think back even just 2 years. Would you have gotten the Premier of Ontario, the Prime Minister of Canada, and the Mayor of Toronto in Pride?
Rob Ford, who called Justin Trudeau a, quote, fag? Yeah, that's the guy you're going to get in Pride. So it's a sea change, really. And the fact that the Prime Minister was there, and people were going nuts, as they do, when Trudeau shows up.
Right? Trudeau mania.
He could be our gayest Prime Minister yet. Even though, you know what I mean, though. Like, he's popular in the community, and people are happy there.
Yeah.
And it's definitely a good thing. It's unprecedented that he was. It's not obviously not unprecedented in all... in all countries. It might be something to check into, because, I mean, you're not going to see Donald Trump at that parade and the equivalent in the States.
No.
But, yeah, so, of course, yeah, with there would be a heavier police presence there with just Trudeau and Secret Service and you name it, too. And I'm not sure. I don't think Black Lives Matter would be objecting to, let's say, single police not in uniform being in the parade, if that's just your job. But then you say to yourself, okay, well, which group do you associate yourself with? And because, I mean, to get in the parade, you need a float. And I don't think people, it's not like a regular parade where people just join in and march at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something as well. But I mean, it was like, it's, I think it went just from having the local police and Toronto police. There was, like, I think hundreds of officers within the parade, you know, not just covering the parade as well. And I'm sure that there's definitely other people in the community that would object to that, because it's, you know, how much has really changed,
right?
Especially for the Black LGBTQT community.
Yeah,
and I think that's the point that we're trying to make. It's like you guys are saying everything is sunshine and roses, and we're saying there is still these outstanding issues, and you need to address them. And that's what they've done.
There's not outstanding issues.
It's the technique that people
are It's like, you know, imagine shutting down the Santa Claus parade for, you know, I don't know, because you're protesting
capitalism.
Christian or capitalism, even that. Like, yeah, protesting capitalism, you've shut down the Santa Claus parade. They never make it out of there alive, I guarantee.
No.
It's funny that we're talking about the corporatization of Pride, because there was a group marching called Gay Zombies Cannabis Consumers Association.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like a parade.
And they have nothing to do with zombies, cannabis, or consumers. It is the thin veil that this anti-LGBT Christian group was using. They were wearing these like green body suits and handing out what looked like condoms, but were actually carefully folded pamphlets with anti-gay stuff. So it's like they're becoming part of the, and it's led by, I can't remember the guy's name, but he's tried to shut down Pride events all across the country.
Is that the guy that's always screaming on the corner of Yonge and Dundas? There's that guy with the megaphone who's just always yelling about the gays.
You'll have to narrow that down, but
you're right. Sorry, now that I think about it, you're right. It's just that when I'm there, which isn't often now anymore, I used to be there all the time.
But
when it was jeans, that's a whole nother. That was many, many moons ago.
I did find some of the protesting against the protest hilarious, because like it's one of the few times that columnists like Margaret Wente and Sue Ann Levy and Barbara Kay like got on the side of the LGBT community. The most hilarious one, though, was Sue Ann Levy, who
is gay.
Yes. Yes.
Just so people know who we're talking about.
But she said the thing is that the Black Lives Matter protest was keeping down a true community that's been undermined, which is conservative gay people.
Well, there may be some truth to that, because there's so many of them still in the closet.
Well, I'm just one, right? Like who's keeping the conservative gay people down more, their own party or Black Lives Matter? And of course, this was I was actually reading the Physical Sun, so on Monday, and this was like
an actual newspaper.
Yeah,
wow.
This was the next page over from a column she wrote about how you know, wanting a downtown relief line of the subway is more of this downtown elitism, like being focused on downtown matters to the exclusion of everyone else in Toronto. Spoken like someone who doesn't ride the subway at 5 o'clock on a weekday.
No.
At Queen Station.
That's something now.
Yeah. I want to do this too. I want to just like point this out. There was news, breaking news today, because I think you're a Trekkie, right?
Yeah, somewhat, yeah.
Okay.
Not diehard, but I do know the...
Yeah, but you're a fan.
Yes, I would say I'm a fan, yeah.
Yeah, because there was news today that in honor of George Takei, they're going to reveal in the next Star Trek movie that comes out in a couple of weeks that Sulu is gay.
Sulu's going gay.
Yeah.
Right on.
They're
going
to show Sulu with his husband and daughter in the next Star Trek movie.
Space husband or...
I don't know if space husband, but I mean, he just works in space. Doesn't have to be a space husband.
Space husband from Earth. That's
so
exciting.
Yeah.
Because George Takei is he has like a kabillion followers on all social media.
Yeah.
He's probably done more for LGBTQ awareness for a lot of people.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of somebody who is famous and outspoken, he could be the guy, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was...
always
he came out after Schwarzenegger vetoed the equal marriage bill in
California.
Austin
Powers said, I didn't know Sulu was gay, man. Anyway.
I think that was Liberace.
Yes. You name it.
Okay. This is going to be somewhat less controversial, or maybe it is, depending on how you like to get your missives. But Canada Post is struggling with the possibility of a lockout. Canada Post is going to lock out the members of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. They gave 72-hour notice on Tuesday, so the lockout was supposed to be on Monday, but then, as I said at the top, they've postponed it till Monday. And this is going to get into the good, like, sort of mechanics of labor relations, where I know Scotty lives. But the key...
A little rusty, but yeah, I'll be okay.
The key issue seems to be, aside from the usual things like, you know, pay raises, but the key thing seems to be wanting to basically change around the benefits, the pension plans. They want to switch it from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution one. Now, defined benefit is you get a check every month regardless. The contribution one is, you know, we're going to take the money, we're going to invest it, and if the well goes empty, it goes empty. And, yes. I mean, obviously one sounds way better than the other, but the flip side is, and this is a problem that's coming down the pike in all sectors that have pension plans, the former might definitely kind of bankrupt the taxpayer when you're talking about it. And perhaps not like literally bankrupt, but, you know, that well might eventually run dry regardless.
Well, and that's the implication. And the thing with defined contribution is that, you know, if the economy tanks, then your pension tanks as well, whereas, you know, there's a certain stable amount. And it's sorry, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's not as gold-plated as people think. Deepak Chopra, when he leaves Canada Post, there'll be a nice gold-plated something or other for him.
Yeah.
There isn't for the regular person carrying packages. Now, to clarify as well, and we've talked about this before,
mm-hmm.
a lockout is not a strike.
Right.
And that's what was weird in 2011, which is possibly the last time we talked about this, was that the postal workers had a bit of a rotating strike going on. Still workable, though. Still, the mail is still going out. Then they were locked out. Then they were legislated back by the Conservatives, which is always...
dicey.
It's dicey, and it's one of those things that's... It's still... They take every opportunity, in my view, to make the workers look bad. Now, there's 50,000 people work for Canada Post, right? And part of what Cup W and the workers are arguing is that...
Cup W.
Cup W is what they used to call it. That they don't want a two-tiered system. So it's like if the person working next to you should have the same pension plan as you do if you're with the firm, right? If you're working... There shouldn't be any difference between those. Something else they were also arguing for, which I thought was very interesting, was pay equity for people that do rural postal routes.
Yeah.
Now, I know that sounds like a bit of a snooze, but it sounds like women in particular who are doing the rural routes, delivering the post, are paid 28% less than somebody doing the same thing in the city.
Yeah.
Which isn't right at all. It's a pay equity issue, right? So to bring that up, whatever.
It seems weird, too. But, like a weird... you know, to you work make more in the city versus...
Rural delivery is a bit of a different world, but I'll tell you, when I was living out of the country, it was pretty amazing how quickly a letter could get in the city. It's probably not the same now. That was a long time ago. But
18 dickety six.
The coach came by and two horses, and I gave them a little sugar cube. No, it's not that long ago. But, yeah, so it's, and this comes up every time. And there's, I want to say Scott Hamilton, one of the spokespeople. He said something really weird. They're talking about, you know, there's certain mail that's guaranteed to get through. Now, I'm not even sure. There's, I guess, some people left that still get the government check in the mail. Most people just get direct deposit. I don't know what the percentage is. But he said the exact words he used, what the federal socioeconomic checks will still get through. And I was like, who speaks like that? What are you talking about?
It sounds like a term he invented.
The socioeconomic checks.
So that
like,
he doesn't...
You deadbeats that are on benefits are still going to get your checks. That's what it sounded like to me.
What it sounds like to me, he didn't want to list it. Like, you'll get your child tax credit, your disability tax credit, your old age pension, your CPP,
free.
Your veterans. Like, it just seems like an umbrella
government
term.
Government money, you deadbeat. So,
I don't think he meant
no,
that.
No, I don't know. I don't know. I'm probably reading too much into it. It was just a really weird way to put it.
Yeah.
So the other thing is, too, is that when this came out, and I just read the press release this morning, was that the way it was worded, the Canada Post said that the union were saying no to binding arbitration. I think what the union is trying to say is that they are still willing to sit down, and I don't think that's coming out in the media.
Mm.
As far as I understand it, they still want to talk. Canada Post is implying that the workers have walked away, that they're not talking anymore. But on the CUPW website, you'll see that these are the one we met. Now, when they meet, sometimes they don't talk at all. It's just an exchange of paperwork. They'll say, okay, this is our final offer.
Yeah.
But it sounds like they've gone to them and say, well, we will accept binding arbitration. That's not really how the process works, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has to sort of play itself out, either lockout or strike, and then they can talk about binding, going back to the table and binding arbitration, which needs to be implemented, right? So Canada Post seems to be doing it a bit ass backwards in terms of what the way negotiations work. The Liberals, they have come out and said, we're all for fair negotiations, and we want people to bargain in good faith. Yet somehow that doesn't seem to be happening. And in fact, the union has filed a complaint to the Canada Labor Relations Board regarding this, saying that, you know, they haven't bargained good faith. They've come up with this number about, well, we'll be out $1 billion, but they have nothing to back it up. It's like what Trump does. He just picks a number. It's like $1 billion.
That's not weird for labor negotiations.
No, but
though.
Have you seen any hard numbers as to where this $1 billion is going?
No.
They've just said $1 billion.
I'm just saying it's not an unusual tactic, because I remember with the transit lockout a couple of years ago here in town.
Yeah.
There was like, it's going to bankrupt the city, live into all their demand. Like, that's a bit hyperbolic, but I mean, that was the intent. It's just every list of demand will kill us financially, and the truth is somewhere in between.
Well, it's their job to prove that, though, right?
I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying this is a tactic, because it gets to the reptilian brain. It's like, they want to just take the money.
They took our money.
Take the money.
They took our taxpayers' money and jobs.
Yes.
So, do you not want things to delivered, but
if you have a small business, you want things delivered, because
that is huge, because it isn't about postcards and letters to your ma anymore. It is about packages, right?
Yeah.
And it's profitable.
Yeah.
Canada Post hasn't lost money. They're saying that they will lose money, but they haven't lost money. I'm searching for the number in my chicken scratch as to where it is, but I mean,
$8 billion last year, but I mean
that's gross. So I mean
that was gross. Yeah. I mean profit. It's like about $200 million profit. So they're not hurting.
So they're not $200 million in the hole. Then
no,
that's what we're saying.
No, they're not hurting.
No, I mean, but somehow they're saying we're going to be out $1 billion. Okay, how come? That'd be my only question. Like, okay, tell us why.
It's still the most economical way to send a package, and that is huge for all. You know, we're talking about all these small businesses, all these people who make crafts or specialty clothes, sell it through Etsy or their own little site, and do e-commerce. And it's so much cheaper to send something for $5-$10 through Canada Post and like $20-$30.
Yep.
Through. UPS or DHL.
Or Purolator, which is owned by Canada Post.
Purolator is owned. But that's true, too.
And if I understand it right, medical marijuana can only be shipped by the mail. Well, no, that's a lot of people. I don't know how many people in Canada
are. No, I disagree.
It can only go through Canada Post due to security reasons. So
yeah,
that's another thing.
Couldn't they just put in like a plain brown box like this, like the Stag Shop does?
I guess so.
You could just...
You would hope we'll get there. I don't know if they can send it legally through. It must be some sort of... But that's the thing, too. I mean, most countries have a postal service to varying degrees. In certain places, it's been privatized, like it was in the UK. And I think there's the implication that that's what may happen here, is that if you beat it down enough, then they will just privatize it. The Royal Mail, right. I think the UK government, or whatever it's going to be now, made something like $3 billion or pounds on the sale of the Royal Mail. So it's like, is that where they're trying to, should we just work this thing into the ground and kill it, and then it can sort of run on its own, and then, corporate interests and profitable types will make money, and we don't have to pay these union people.
Right, and that's the thing. There's like so many things now where nobody knows what the future of them is going to be. Like, I'm thinking about things like newspapers or the mail. We're so busy trying to like sort of keep up to where it is and where it's been that we're not kind of thinking about the future of it. Does it make more sense for Canada Post to start focusing its business on as a parcel delivery service? But they also have ancillary things like the specialty stamps and they sell like all the specialty coins, all the Canadian Mint stuff out of the post office as well.
And maybe they would save some money if they got rid of that, right? But is everything on the table or not? And some of the things have been suggested. I think they're coming up with a government panel to look at this too. And it has been suggested by the union and others is postal banking.
Yeah,
which used to be a thing.
Yeah,
both in Canada and the U.S. and places where. There'd be a remote outpost where there's no bank. You could do your basic banking. I don't know if it was investments and things, but if you just wanted to do basic banking and they had money behind them, you could do your bank at the post office. To me, it sounds like a great idea, but if it's coming from the workers, then, Canada Post is just going to say, no, forget it.
But nobody's taking a minute to think about that stuff. It's all just a scramble to sort of keep the status quo going for as long as it can. And then... of course, the other thing that hasn't come up in this conversation at all, in this conversation, is all the promises that the federal government made when they were running to restore services. Mm-hmm. And where does that fit in the equation? Because that was a lot of jobs right there for delivering mail to places where it's just like a 6-foot box with 30 drawers in it.
Yep.
That used to be somebody's job.
Yeah, and they've just kind of stepped back from that, and they're saying we're just going to let them negotiate. I'm not sure if the Liberals would legislate them back to work, but I don't know.
It would be pretty bad optics.
It would be pretty bad optics, but because the Conservatives made a massive habit. It was a habit of legislating anything that they considered remotely crucial. But there's, I don't think this will kill Canada Post. It may beat it up a little.
Yeah.
Along the lines of postal banking, too, I was in Chicago, and honestly, I just wanted a stamp, and I didn't know how to do that. So, you go to the post office. And while I was there, they were doing very interesting things like swearing people in as, passports and stuff like that. I think there's lots of unexamined potential for places like Canada Post and all these little large and small offices where they could be doing stuff. Because it is a federal agency, if they were given the blessing to do it.
Yeah.
But yet, it just becomes all about the... Well, I guess the bottom line is it is all about the packages, but I think if it wasn't for online sales and that, they probably would have been in a lot more trouble.
Oh, for sure. But you know who would have a big problem ordering the Canada Post workers back to work?
Who?
Our next guest, James Gordon.
Oh, yes.
So we're going to take a break for some music and some PSAs, and we will bring James in, and we'll start that conversation after the break here on Open Sources Guelph. You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Some tried to save me. Folks mostly said I was just old, and they gave me a sentence of death. And they'll all give a cheer when bulldozers and dump trucks clear me out of here. In my parlor there once was a teary farewell to a son heading off into World War I's hell. Even more tears when he didn't come home. A mother in my front hall cried. crying into the phone. I'm just an old farmhouse, and that's so passé. Who cares about farms anymore anyway? Farmhands laughed in my kitchen about who worked the hardest as they shared a taste.
Currently sitting at number 6 on the CFRU Folk Roots Blues chart, that was James Gordon from his new CD, Sunny Jim.
We have a Folk Roots Blues chart?
We do.
Wow.
And it's not often that we have the person in the studio that is the same. It's almost like a music show for a brief.
Yeah. It's like the one time we have a music show.
And somebody's on the charts, too, so there you go.
Really, yeah, he's bestseller.
Here we go.
So, obviously, we're talking about James Gordon, Ward 2 counselor for the City of Guelph. James, welcome back to CFRU.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You are always welcome here, of course, because this is where your CDs are.
That's it. I saw them on the shelf out there.
That's right.
He counted them.
So you wanted to make sure if there was one missing.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, just to make sure.
Replace.
Let's talk about music for a minute because, I mean, technically, council is a part-time job, which obviously forces you to make your musical career a part-time job. So how has balancing two part-time jobs been lately?
People say, well, James, how do you balance it? And I think my answer is, I don't. Why do you think I'm balancing it? It's chaos. Yeah.
Some honesty in practice
right.
there. That's great.
Well, it's changed my touring habits, of course, because I used to go out. If I was on tour, I'd go out for 6 weeks or something. But now I'm mostly Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I'm flying more, which is bad for my carbon karma. But it's actually at a time in the music business when it's in a real state of flux, too. And there's not as much work for old guys like me out there anyway. So I'm pleased. On the days that it feels like I am balancing it, it feels like an interesting combination that I'm trying to stay up for the challenge.
But it's not like the two worlds are sort of so distant because you sing a lot about social justice matters and it's political to an extent.
Yeah, and I think it was actually Charlie Angus and Jack Layton that got me into this politics game saying, James, it's not that different a gig. You know, you don't have a guitar in your hand, but you have to relate to people. You have to be responsive to them. You have to try to find a way to communicate that resonates with them. And I'm finding a lot of similarities, actually.
That's a good segue because I was going to ask you, you ran for political office twice, ran for council. Again, you're no stranger to politics and activism, but I mean, now you are on an actual decision-making
That's
body.
Right.
So is it everything you hoped it would be?
Everything I hoped and less. No.
Give me the Mercury tomorrow. Yeah.
Actually, cool. I think that the interesting thing is I've spent all too many years standing outside city halls and legislatures with placards and being protesting guy. So I'm only doing this because I thought, well, could I make a difference being on the inside? And I think that it's hard to let go of the rah, 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 let's change this, and because it's a slower process from the inside. But I think working on the outside so much has brought a perspective to that inside stuff that I think it's enabling me. I'm learning how to work within the system and get some stuff done.
Is it interesting wearing the shoes on the other foot, you know, where you would stand out in front of those places and say, like, why can't you get this done? And now you know why that can't get done.
I know, and that's been a humbling experience a little bit. And I think I think riding that line has been helpful because having been there and now having been where I am now, I can empathize with the ones on the outside shaking their banners. But I also can have a cautionary thing too. Well, maybe standing out there and yelling isn't the most effective way to get something done. By the same token, I get frustrated a lot when sitting around a horseshoe sometimes doesn't feel like we're getting anything done. So somehow I'm just picking up tools along the way.
Well, speaking of tools, no.
The tool library. That's a good
idea. Yeah, that is a good idea. Yeah. Open house coming up on next Saturday, I believe.
I think, yeah.
I don't want to actually talk about the tool library. Not that it's not a good service or anything. Yeah. There was something that obviously came out of corporate services this week.
Oh, yeah.
A big issue that got a lot of people talking about living wage.
Yeah.
And I wasn't aware of this, but there are apparently 27 people at the waste recycling plant who aren't making or are differently paid than everyone else.
That's right. In fact, that's why I didn't expect it to be as much of an issue as it was when it came to the committee, because what our goal was and the motion that was presented was to become an official living wage city.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different levels of that, but the basic one is when all your full-time employees are making a living wage.
Right.
We were only 27 employees shy of that, and they are all the sorters out at the waste plant.
Right.
But they were only, I think, 8 or 10 cents an hour shy of it.
Right.
So it would have actually only cost us $5,000 to bring them up to there, so that we were hoping that that would send a message, that commitment that we're making, that would inspire other corporations and communities to get on board, because we've seen the economic value to a community in it. But it turned out it wasn't really about the money at all. It became very ideological, very political, and I was pretty surprised by the results.
Is it because they are on contract? Yeah,
they're not on contract. They actually are union members.
Okay.
It just turns out that their contract is, the union contract is up in 2019.
Right.
But I think it's ironic that it's a garbage place, because they're at the bottom of the heap in some ways.
So they're just in a different band of.
Yeah. Okay. So the hope would be that next time it came up for a union contract negotiation, that the city could say, you know what, we're committed to making them giving them a living wage. There's different levels of living wage, too, depending on whether there's a benefit package to it. So it just didn't, I was surprised to know that we were that close and that all the employees, we have a lot of part-time employees, and that would be another level of commitment that we know would take a while to get to. But I was disappointed and surprised that we couldn't make that just that one symbolic gesture anyway.
It seems to be happening a lot that there's something perhaps simple comes up at council and there's an ideological bend. And a lot of people in the community talk about it, that it seems that we can't work things out because the perception of giving 27 people $5,000 more per year affects bona fides concerning, people wanting to be fiscally reserved.
Yeah, and I think that's where, I think we've talked about this before, Adam, where I find the dissonance on council I didn't think it was that ideological. I thought it was more around short-term versus long-term thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So in the short term, you might say, well, we don't want to spend that money to raise them up to living wage now, because these are tough times.
Mm-hmm.
But the long-term vision is do that. It means they're going to be paying more taxes, those people. They're going to be purchasing more local products. They're going to have more loyalty towards their employer. They're going to be healthier. There's so many. We've just seen so many best practices around the economic value you get for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, but that takes a bit of a long-term vision, which I'm not sure is there on the council in some days. Like the day we had that committee meeting, it just wasn't there. And I was surprised when, the ideology comes out. The mayor, in fact, to his credit, was totally honest when he said, I'm a free market kind of a guy. This doesn't fit that. And I would disagree. And he also said, I think now legendary comment, just even though it's just a few days ago, we'll say, why is it always these lefties that make it a moral, ethical issue?
He actually said that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think that I thought that was an insult to righties, because shouldn't decisions being made from the business community have a moral, ethical aspect to it as well? So I was very surprised to hear that, and yet it guides us. And again, I talk about I talk about short and long-term vision, but there's a big picture thing, too, is I think if there's a reticence about going to some of those places like that living wage, it's because there's also in the back of some counselors and maybe the mayor's mind is, well, could some of these services we save by privatizing them?
Mm.
And I know that's been talked about. So it wouldn't be any advantage then. Let's unload that instead of upgrading it. So that's a big issue on itself.
The idea that perhaps you don't want to do anything to enhance it when it could be gone.
Yes, that's right.
In a year or two.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about another thing that's sort of a hot topic, transit.
Yeah.
The Guelph Transit, after a council decision last week, added buses to certain routes. I know that everyone around the horseshoe has gotten an earful over the last several weeks.
For sure.
And I'm wondering, and it's almost 1 week since we've got those extra buses added. And is your inbox a little lighter these days, or are people still?
I think it is, although the inbox has changed its tone now. And that we see it's why. The tone now is, why the hell did we do this in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
instead of, hey, I can't get to my bus on time. So now they're saying, okay, we've eased the pressure a little bit, but how did we get this pressure in the first place? What was the decision-making mechanism that allowed us to do that? And frankly, I think that it was one of council's biggest mistakes at budget time. It wasn't going to cost us the money that we saved to trim those routes for the summer schedule was pretty insignificant compared to how much it disrupted a lot of people's lives.
And I always come down to, speaking of free market, just if you go to the Guelph Transit Facebook page and the rating, it's a business page, so which means people can rate it.
Okay,
right?
Sure.
So if you look at the rating, it's like, I think the last time I looked last week, it was 1.7 out of 5 stars.
And if you want to check that out.
Yeah, if you want to make the business case, what's more business than user feedback or customer feedback?
Oh, for sure. And
which is always horrible in the case of transit.
And in fact, with transit, why cutting back services is, to me, the opposite of what we should be doing. Anything that we can do to boost ridership, the main ways to do that is with efficiency, reliability, and frequency. So if it looks to someone like, hey, that's pretty darn easy to take that bus and it gets me where I want to go on time, I'm not going to get in an Uber cab. I'm not going to get in my car. And the more people that find that there an appetite for that, then when our ridership goes up, we save in a lot of other ways too. And again, that goes back to the short-term thinking. And I think one of the things we need to address in the fall around transit is the ratio between how much should transit really pay for itself through fares.
Right.
I think we owe it to our community to shift that so that it's not necessarily a subsidy. It's investing in our transit system so that it fulfills a community need.
Yeah, and I think that's a broader discussion that needs to take place because we get caught in this. I mean, it seems like as an observer, we're caught in a nickel and diming sort of thing where, you know, some stuff in government is going to be invariably be a loss leader. And I think transit is something like that.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. I also wanted to talk about something big is going on in your ward, the Homewood redevelopment.
Yeah.
And I find it fascinating because Homewood is something, I think everybody knows Homewood.
Sure.
In Guelph. Very few of us have the need to go to visit, yes, Knockwood, to visit someone. But I mean, it's this huge institution in the city.
Yeah.
So what's this redevelopment of the site?
I was just that they had an open house just 10 days ago or so. And the confusing part is that it is a major redevelopment. They want to add like a 6-story complex to the side and really, really make it the centerpiece. There are now the same company, the Schlegels, that own it have... Mm-hmm. Wasn't it 13 of them all around the country now? So this would be sort of their headquarters. However, the confusion in the community is that what they've decided to do to help fund this development is to sever the property, to give them some remortgaging power, and that severance is basically the wilderness part of the property. It's the largest woodlot in the city limits,
yeah,
as far as I know, and it's historical value, and they say, well, but we're not going to do anything with it. We're just going to sever it. But there's a level of trust in the community around that. Well, so if you're not going to do anything with it, why are you severing it? I think there's still confusion, and I think we need to sort that out. The just because the Schlegels say we won't do it, I think we need somehow an assurance. What I'd love to see, I mean, if it's severed, it would be open for a future council that maybe had a different mind frame of saying, well, look, it's sitting there. There's an opportunity for development. We'll make a lot more tax dollars on it that
right.
way. But it'd be lovely, and I don't think it'll happen, but if the city ended up owning it, you know, or it was given in a trust, I think there's a lot of reasons why that should be maintained as an urban forest.
Mm-hmm. This, I'd happen to be in the hospital, and they seem to be clearing a bunch of trees out.
Yeah.
Was that sort of pre-planned, or is it, I guess it's private property?
That's a flag. I've been getting a lot of calls about
that. A lot of sawdust
that.
Over there.
Yeah, and what they say is that they're doing woodlot management.
Right.
And yet it looks like there's more trees being cut that would just demonstrate that.
It's pretty noticeable. My mind goes up on the seventh floor, so you can look over and see. But
no, I have people quite concerned about that.
Yeah.
So they want to sever the land with the actual facility on from the land that has the natural.
That's right. It actually includes, the severed part would include Riversleigh, the historic home, the old Goldie mansion there,
right.
too. So it's kind of the south section of it.
And I've actually seen that house. It was a friend of mine did Fall of the House of Usher, play, and he used that as a model, and I went down and shot it for him, the outside of it.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a fabulous
With
spot.
A camera.
Okay, yeah.
Just to clarify.
Yeah, just to be, yeah. I was, yeah. So it's beautiful grounds.
Oh, for sure. I think that the other concern from a Ward 2 standpoint is that will this increase development, what will that do to the actual traffic in the neighborhood? Delhi Street itself, is it built for that? Because we've already got the hospital there. Can it handle it while still maintaining its integrity? They're talking about knocking down the nurse's residence across the street and making that a parking lot. And while it doesn't seem to be qualified as a designated historically, I think that there's a heritage streetscape there to bear in mind, too. Like, how would that change just the feel and the look of the street? That's what I'm hearing from the neighbors.
Interesting. Before we wrap up, I wanted to touch on, too, I'm mistaken, but it seems like you're taking point on making sure that the First Nations people get recognized at the beginning of every council, the Attawateron peoples, that we tip our hat at the beginning of every council meeting to them. It seems like such an obvious thing.
I know. Well, Adam, I thought it was, too. So it wasn't quite happening. So that's when it shouldn't just happen as a matter of course, but to make it official protocol was the motion that I brought forward, and it passed unanimously. It was great to hear. So now it means, yes, it'll be done. And I have to say, it's been very rewarding to find out what seems like a very simple gesture has meant a lot to our Indigenous community here.
Mm-hmm. And it's a bigger community than you might think.
Yeah.
And that's something we learn all the time. When is that going to go into effect? Because I know there's wording issues.
Yeah, so it's back to staff to consult with elders in the community to find the wording. And I wish I could say that was an easy thing, but there's, you know, we have the Attawandaran people, but there was a Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, who considered this part of their heritage as well, too.
The Mississaugas, inroads in here.
That's
too.
Right. So do you end up just saying we're on First Nations land, or how do you do it? So I think that there's going to be a consultation process, and I'm so whenever we get through that, we'll be ready to rock.
Okay, because that was kind of from my mom too, who loved this idea, but she was like, "Well, what kind of wording do we need?" It's pretty straightforward. I wanted to ask you about this too. I'm seeing signs up around that say, are there lead in your pipes?
Oh, yeah.
To tell you to call the city of Guelph if you want to find out. And it's sort of funny seeing these signs out of context just along the streets.
Right.
And I'm sure I'm not alone in wondering.
Don't panic.
Is it time to panic?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yes. Let's run screaming into the street now. Actually, what I know about it is that they are targeting neighborhoods that have ancient infrastructure in the and might have lead pipes, and it's a great service that they're offering. To be honest, I got calls of confusion because those signs look like it's a business.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, are they trying to sell me something? But it's actually generated by the city, and they'll, to ease your panic, they will investigate for you, and if they find it, they'll tell you what to do about it. So not a lot of the pipes now that come from the main hookup water into the houses haven't, but there still are some, and it's a health concern for sure.
It's funny you mentioned, like, is it a business? Because that was my first thought.
Oh, yeah.
And it has the City of Guelph logo on the side in white.
Yeah.
But you associate City of Guelph stuff. And maybe that's just great branding with the light green and the light blue color.
Yeah. And I was worried people, you know, the guy's going to go around with clipboards and say, hey, can we look at your lead pipes? And people saying, no, I don't think so.
Yeah. There's a lot of,
you know. It looked like an election sign, too.
Yeah, it does.
Vote lead 2017. Yeah. lead out. In 2017.
Oh, I like it. Yeah.
Before we wrap up, we were talking that it's the summertime and it's good touring time, but I think it's also a good time to think about what's coming up in the fall and what council's going to do when September comes around again. So what's on your radar?
Well, we will be shifting in some way to this new council as a whole, and I'm very curious to see how that works. I think I'm optimistic. That, well, for instance, that vote about living wage would have been a very different vote if every councillor had had a vote on it at the committee.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll be gearing up towards budget season. And I know that I'm starting now. I know a lot of the other councillors are, just to gauge the community. And I'd like to make sure we have a total cultural shift around the budget towards offering the best value for your tax dollars, not the an artificial low number that means we will have to cut bus service and things like that. So what's going to address the well-being of this community while still keeping it affordable? And that's the balance.
Oh, and people are sort of warming up for that. I did notice on your blogs, people posting like, I can't pay higher taxes.
Yeah,
and I mean, how do you respond to that? It's such a visceral thing. Like, I'm not sure what this woman's situation is. It does sound like she's on a fixed income, but
sure.
When I hear that, it's just like, well, what do you do? What do you say?
Yeah. Well, actually, it's our new CAO has a line that he fed me that I started to use. Where if they're grumbling about their property taxes and they have a right to, it's hard to pay your property taxes. Say, well, how much have they gone up in the last 10 years? And they'll tell you, and they say, well, how much has the value of your home gone up in 10 years? And how much has your cost of your groceries gone up? And everything's gone up. So why should that one thing not go up? And sometimes that gives them a pause. And sometimes I'll say, okay, if we're feeling a will in the city to freeze the taxes, what are you willing to give up for it? But there's a trap in there, because you'd be surprised at what some people say they'd give up.
Like the buses.
Yeah, like the buses. Like the library. Like, I don't go to the parks, so why do you keep the parks? Why do you have people in the parks? Yeah. So it is, you get surprises that way. So it's not an easy answer, but you have to, just like we talked, we're wrapping around the conversation, just like the music business, you got to listen to people. You have to try to reflect back what you're hearing from them, but I'll offer them alternatives. Instead of saying, I'm sorry, I'm raising your taxes. That's not what they want to hear. You want to say, here's why it probably can't stay at a zero, but here's what we're trying to do to keep it affordable and yet still meet the needs, especially around our infrastructure and just keeping that enviable quality of life that we've got in the city going.
Well, I love it when we end things full circle.
Hey, all right. Nice
James,
work.
Where can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can come to go to my city, james.gordon@guelph.ca, or you can, if it's a show business thing, I have a website, jamesgordon.ca. I also have a Ward 2 blog, and I would love it. I'd like to expand that more. And you can come out Thursday mornings to visit me.
Yes.
Where have you been? Where have you been?
I've been working.
Okay.
I'm a writer. You want me to get up at 8 a.m.?
Breezy Corners breakfast every Thursday morning. It's become a little bit of an incubator for ideas. And then we get...
Nice. It's huge.
Yeah. It's been getting bigger every week. This morning we had to get an extra couple tables going. And
amazing.
It's a very cool thing. So it's a way to... keep in touch with those constituents.
We'll have to go on a tour.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know
anything. Yeah,
breakfast tour.
We'll come one of these mornings.
All right.
But not next week, because we have other matters next week. We have Ward 6 Councillor Mark McKinnon in studio with us next week. So if you have any questions for him, feel free to send those to us, and I'll tell you how. You can get in touch with us at opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter, and of course listen to every episode on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or iTunes. You can subscribe through iTunes as well. You can find me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at a place called The Spanner Book. And Sunny Jim, available on Borealis Records.
Nice plug.
By James
Thank
Gordon.
You. All right.
In my hands. I'm going to get him an autograph.
Yay.
James would tell you the check's in the mail if it weren't for the situation we discussed earlier.
Yes, that's right.